Thank you, Chris, for organizing all of this. It's good to be here. Thank you all for coming as well. Let's see. The handout I gave out, everything's going to be discussed in the paper, so no worries there for our cyber attendees. Should be good. Oh, yes, sorry. I'm Lewis Schwartz. I'm currently finishing my PhD in history at the University of Toronto under Joe Gehring, who was also a student of Father Boyle's. I'm working on Richard Fishacre's Sentences Commentary, a study and edition of part of that, book four on the last thing. So it's good fun. But today I'm speaking about Thomas of Ireland and angels and devils and the university context. So we'll see. Should be fun. So all right, let me just get started. So I posit as the starting point of this paper a reasonable assumption. Thomas of Ireland's Manipulus Florum has been, for many centuries, such a popular and often copied text because it is useful. And here I recall that according to Richard and Mary Rouse's count, Thomas's hefty florilegium survives in over 180 medieval manuscripts and in roughly 50 printed editions. And thanks to the effort of Chris Nyman and his colleagues, we now possess an online critical edition. Various theories have been recently proposed to explain such sustained and persistent interest in this text. The Rouses, in their seminal study published in 1979 through the Pontifical Institute, proposed that Thomas of Ireland intended his Manipulus Florum to serve principally as a preaching aid. And they show that generations of preachers used the Manipulus Florum to construct their sermons. In response to the Rouse's study, Chris Nyman argues that Thomas of Ireland instead intended his collection of authoritative sayings to serve primarily as a manual of self-formation, one aimed especially at clerics involved in the cure of souls. Refining Nyman's position, the late Father James McAvoy posits that Thomas crafted the Manipulus Florum as a compendium of private spiritual reading, its various dicta serving as material for pious meditation and reflection. In this paper, I hope to advance the scholarly conversation about the intended uses and usefulness of this popular florilegium by describing how Thomas's target audience, that is, medieval university students, might have employed this text in their theological training. To this end, we will examine Thomas's construction of the entries Angelus and Diabolus, angel and devil, headings which together comprise 42 authoritative quotations. Unlike Nyman's study of the topic predicatio, preaching, and McAvoy's analysis of the heading amicitia, friendship, my presentation today will situate the specific contents of the Manipulus Florum within the larger theological curriculum established at the University of Paris during the late 13th and early 14th centuries. The headings Angelus and Diabolus are particularly well suited for such contextualization, since both the celestial and infernal spirits were, at the time, topics of intense theological inquiry. Adopting Peter the Chanter's tripartite division of the scholastic enterprise into lectio, disputatio, and predicatio, I hope to show just how useful, or even unuseful at times, Thomas's Manipulus Florum would have been as an academic resource supporting the core theological exercises of attending lectures on Peter Lombard's sentences, that would be lectio, of entertaining disputed questions, disputatio, and of listening to sermons, predicatio. Thomas himself, as a bachelor in theology, would have experienced these three academic exercises firsthand. He even possessed personal copies of Peter of Tarentaise's Sentences Commentary and of Giles of Rome's Cor Libeta, a text which contain detailed information about angels and demons. Additionally, Thomas and all other university students, who were of course clerics, either de facto or at least de jure, would have regularly heard sermons, particularly on major liturgical feasts. One of these feasts is dedicated to the angels, particularly to St. Michael, and falls on September 29th, marking the start of the medieval academic year. Many model sermon collections, including one donated by Robert of Sorbonne through the library bearing his name, a library which Thomas knew intimately and used regularly. These collections of sermons dedicate considerable attention to this angelic feast. Thus, by comparing the entries under Angelus and Diabolus in the Manipulus Florum to the angelological material contained in Pierre of Tarentaise's Sentences Commentary, in Giles of Rome's Cor Libeta, and in one remarkable model sermon contained in the Sorbonne's library, we can discern the ways in which Thomas's Florilegium would have been helpful for university students studying theology around the year 1300. So that's a general plan for the paper. So let us start with the material on angels and demons contained in the Manipulus Florum. Under the headings Angelus and Diabolus, Thomas supplies his readers with a remarkably diverse array of authoritative dicta. I have selected and translated a few exemplary passages and have organized them under thematic headings on page 1 of the handout, and I should note that my arrangement of these excerpts is arbitrary and does not represent the order in which Thomas presents them in his Manipulus. So let us read these passages together. And we can almost imagine that we're readers of the Manipulus Florum and see what you get out of it. I don't know. So the first heading, skip the page here. The first heading is Guardians and Tempters. And the first entry is under Angelus C. So great is the dignity of souls that each one has, from the moment of its birth, an angel deputed to guard it. Angelus M. As often as you find yourself beset by great temptation and severe distress, call upon your guardian angel, your guide and helper in all life's circumstances. For when you are troubled, he neither dozes nor sleeps, even if for a time he remains hidden. Diabolus H. The first onset of the devil is oppressive and difficult to bear, yet whoever endures this initial assault with a steadfast mind will find the devil weakened in his subsequent attacks. The more the devil is opposed, the more feeble he becomes. The next thematic heading I've chosen is Angelic Vocabulary. Angelus I. We know by the testimony of sacred scripture that there are 9 orders of angels, those being angels, archangels, virtues, powers, principalities, dominions, thrones, cherubim, and seraphim. Angelus K. The term angel designates an office, not a nature. For the blessed spirits of the heavenly fatherland are always spirits, but they cannot always be called angels. They are only angels when they announce something. Hence the psalm, "He who makes his spirits angels." Indeed, in the Greek tongue, angel means messenger, whereas archangel means great messenger. Certain spirits, moreover, are given personal names, such as Michael or Gabriel or Raphael, in order to signify through these words the precise nature of their ministry. And we'll continue reading. We'll see why I wanted to give you all these excerpts as one chunk, and then we'll talk about significance. The next is angelic nature, Angelus H. Angelic nature is distinct from human nature in the following way. We are physically limited to one place and intellectually limited by ignorance. Whereas the angelic spirits are indeed physically limited to one place, but their knowledge is far superior to our own. The angels are filled with knowledge both from within and from without, for they contemplate the very source of all knowledge. Knowing the one who knows all things, can they be ignorant of anything which they should know? Angelus T. The angel is an intellectual substance, always mobile, free in will, incorporeal, serving God, immortal not by nature, but by grace. Only the Creator knows the full beauty and capacity of the angelic nature. Angelus I. The nature of the angels is mutable, because the angels are naturally subject to change, but eternal love has rendered them incorruptible. And we'll finish here with the last subsection, angelic knowledge. I'm trying to show how great of a variety of topics could be included here. Angelus A. The heavenly angels are placed in command over the powers of the air and direct all things which happen here on earth. For the angels behold the fixed and eternal law, a law which commands without writings, without signs, without noise, a law which is decreed and established for all eternity. The angels gaze upon God's pure mind and do here on earth what his law commands. Diabolus A. We are certain that the devil cannot see the internal dispositions of the soul, but he acquires knowledge of our interior thoughts by observing the movement of our bodies and the external expressions of our desires. Indeed, he alone knows the secrets of the heart, concerning whom it is said, "Only you know the hearts of men." And the final entry, Diabolus I. The demons obtain knowledge of the future in three ways: through the subtlety of their nature, through the experience of time, and through the revelation of higher powers. I hope you enjoyed all those readings, but you can imagine doing extensive reading in the Manipulus Forum, how that could get fatiguing if you find these 10 readings. So again, when we think people just read the Manipulus Forum through, maybe, anyway, it's good to have this experience. So now, considering these texts as a whole, and keep in mind that these passages represent only a portion of the material which Thomas includes under Angelus and Diabolus, it is clear that Thomas intended to provide his readers with a wide variety of angelological teachings. It is not clear, however, that Thomas intended these various sayings to serve principally as material for private spiritual reading, as some of them are quite technical and speculative, with, at least to my eyes or ears, immediately apparent moral implications. And while some of these readings may seem well suited to the classroom, nevertheless, many key topics in patristic and scholastic angelology are entirely absent from Thomas's compilation. For example, the demons' rebellion and fall is never addressed, nor is the possibility of the spirits possessing bodies entertained. Yet these are both important topics of academic discussion and debate. How then might Thomas's seemingly hodgepodge collection of diverse auctoritates have been helpful to university students studying theology? To answer this question, let us compare the Manipulus Forum to some contemporary school texts. Peter of Tarentaise's commentary on Lombard sentences, Giles of Rome's Full of Vettel Disputes, and an anonymous sermon for the Feast of St. Michael housed in the Sorbonne Library. And you'll perhaps recall that I've chosen these texts both because Thomas would have likely been familiar with them, he owned personal copies of the first two and had easy access to the third, and because they represent three important aspects of the scholastic enterprise: Lectio, Disputatio, Predicatio. The Dominican, Peter of Tarentaise, studied at Paris before becoming pope in 1276, taking the name Innocent V. Like all bachelors in theology, he had to lecture on the sentences of Peter Lombard before receiving the title of master and the license to teach. Book 2, distinctions 2 through 11 of Lombard's sentences contain a detailed study of the angels and demons, and Peter of Tarentaise, in his commentary, expands upon the numerous angelological issues which the Lombard introduced 100 years earlier. To give a sense of the type of issues which Peter of Tarentaise entertained in his commentary, I have reproduced the major topics discussed in Book 2, Distinctions 2 and 3, just the first distinctions on the angels, first two, on the second page of your handout. And you can follow along now as I run through the various inquiries quickly. So the first section in Distinction 2, De Esse Angeli, examines the being of the angels. Very metaphysical. And the second section, De Mensura Esse Angeli, differentiates between eternity, angelic time, or aeon, and our earthly time, or tempus. The final section in Distinction 2, De Loco Creationis Angelorum, maps out the Empyrean heaven, the home of the angels. Distinction 3 begins with the study of angelic nature, and, using a philosophically rich phrase, calls the angels simple substances and asks whether the angels are composed of form and matter. Don't worry, I won't ask you to resolve that one. The next section in Distinction 3, De Personali Distinctioni Angelorum, identifies the ways in which an angel constitutes an individual person and how he may differ from another angel and from a human soul. The following section, De Causu et Bonitate Angelorum, describes pre-lapsarian angels, exploring the conditions in which all the spirits existed before the demons' rebellion and fall. The next section, De Naturali Cognitioni Angelorum, examines the different objects of angelic knowledge, first spiritual or intellectual objects, then material objects. And the final section in Distinction 3, De Naturali Dilectione Angelorum, scrutinizes the extent of the natural love which the angels initially directed towards God and towards their fellow spirits. These are only two of the 10 distinctions of the angels, so it's quite rich. These various topics only represent, I just said that, two of the 10 distinctions. And even after such a brief and limited survey of one sentence's commentary, we see how rich, complicated, and technical theological study of the angels had become during the second half of the 13th century. While brief introductions to angelic nature and to angelic knowledge are indeed present in the Manipulus Florum, brief, other key concepts are entirely absent, as I mentioned. Most notably, Thomas's Florilegium contains no explanation of the demon's fall and of the good angel's choice to stay with God. Yet, distinctions 3 through 7 of Lombard's sentences are devoted primarily to these topics. So half of the stuff in the sentences is on the demon's fall and the angel's confirmation. Additionally, Distinction 8 focuses on the question of angelic bodies, Distinction 8 in Lombard sentences. But the Manipulus Florum also fails to mention this important issue, and you've got plenty of Augustine on this stuff, but it doesn't make it into the Manipulus Florum. Thus, it seems unlikely that Thomas intended his Manipulus Florum to serve primarily as a manual of self-formation, for students studying theology, and we can discuss this, since his text provides a rather incomplete survey, at least of the key angelological issues. You may have noticed that complex philosophical concepts also play a crucial role in the workings of scholastic angelology, and a glance at Giles of Rome's Quo Libeto questions will confirm this intuition. The Quo Libeto were extraordinary disputations held twice in the academic year during Advent and during Lent, penitential seasons, I mentioned, in which masters of theology would, with the help of their advanced students, respond to a variety of inquiries proposed by those in attendance. Theoretically, the master had no foreknowledge of the topics which would be advanced for discussion. During Quo Libeto sessions, all classes were postponed so that the entire theological community could attend. Giles of Rome hosted 6 Quo Libeto disputations while teaching at Paris between 1286 and 1291. Some of his Quo Libeto concern angels and demons, and I have listed the pertinent questions in the last major section on the handout, which I will now quickly translate. Giles considers, and I'll go in order here, starting with Quo Libeto 1, big Q1, question 8, little Q8, whether, and this is the first one, whether the angelic substance is composed of form and matter and form, is a popular question. Whether angels know singulars, that is, whether they perceive individual objects as such or just generic qualities. Whether the angels can know future contingent events, that is, events involving the free will of other agents. Whether God can make multiple angels in one species. Whether the demons can, through their actions and effect, reveal themselves to us so that, led by rational consideration, we may know that they exist. Whether demons can suffer from hellfire. Whether demons or souls can suffer contrary punishments simultaneously, such as burning and freezing. at the same time. Perhaps you can think of Dante's famous vision of hell, a flame up top and frozen down below, and somehow combining those. This is what Giles talks about. I will leave you, I won't hold my breath though, to read the rest of the questions at your own leisure. In Giles' treatment of these various topics, he repeatedly invokes the Aristotelian tradition, including the authentic works of Aristotle, the popular Liber de Causis, and the various insights of the Stagirites' Arabic commentators. Giles also references the writings of Pseudo-Dionysius, though he obviously calls him Dionysius, on multiple occasions. And similar Aristotelian and Dionysian authorities figure prominently in Peter of Tarentaise's Sentences commentary. Unlike these school texts, the angelic entries in the Manipulus Florum supply its readers with no Aristotelian or Dionysian hardware. The readings contained under Angelus and Diabolus could thus scarcely have prepared a university student for the complex debates one would undoubtedly encounter in the classroom. Nevertheless, I still think that the Manipulus Florum served as an important academic resource, particularly because it contained, as a lengthy appendix, a detailed bibliography of important theological texts. This bibliography lists the various works of 24 prominent patristic and monastic authors, including an incipit and explicit for each entry, which is quite good. The Rouses, moreover, have painstakingly documented that Thomas compiled this bibliography directly from the holdings of the Sorbonne Library. The first author whom Thomas includes in his lengthy list is none other than Dionysius. So, although students using the Manipulus Florum would find none of the essential Dionysian material under the headings Angelus and Diabolus, they could use the appended bibliography to quickly locate the pertinent Dionysian texts within the Sorbonne Library. Students could repeat this process for the other authorities which they encounter during their studies, and thus by regularly referencing Thomas's excellent bibliography, they would considerably expand their knowledge of key theological texts and familiarize themselves with the Sorbonne's impressive collection. This sounds to me like a recipe for academic success. In the prologue to his Manipulus Florum, Thomas stresses the important role he intends his bibliography to play in the scheme of his larger project. He says, quote, "I have listed, at the end of this work, the books of these authors, with their beginnings and endings, and their authors' names, and a number of partial books, so that they can be known more easily and described more accurately." End quote. As we continue to study Thomas's masterwork, we should keep in mind the complementary relations between the dicta and the bibliography if we want to understand more fully the usefulness, influence, and popularity of the Manipulus Florum. And I would also like to note here that although the entries under Angelus and Diabolus do not discuss the fall of Lucifer, Thomas does reference Anselm's important De Casu Diaboli in the appended bibliography. So, you're not off the hook yet. We still have Predicatio. Sorry. It'll be fine. Having examined the Manipulus Florum in relation to the scholastic exercises of Lectio and Disputatio, let us now consider Predicatio. Robert of Sorbonne bequeathed to his namesake institution a massive 6-volume collection of model sermons. One of these volumes, now catalogued in the Bibliothèque Nationale de France as Latin manuscript number 15951, and you have the information at the bottom of your handout. This one manuscript houses an array of sermons de sanctis. This volume contains a number of sermons on Saint Michael and all the angels, a feast celebrated annually on September 29th. I have transcribed and looked closely at the first angelic sermon in this grouping, found on folio 272 recto verso. This anonymous sermon, at least I can try and trace down the authorship, but I haven't had time yet. It's anonymous in the text. And it's not the Bishop of Paris, William of Auvergne's, who also has lots of sermons in there. Anyway, sorry. Keep on topic. This anonymous sermon was clearly intended for an academic audience. It takes as its protema the Pauline text, Omnes sunt administratori spiritus, in ministerium missi propter eos, qui hereditatem capient salutis. In English, they are all ministering spirits, sent to minister for them who shall receive the inheritance of salvation. This passage, says the preacher, as I refer to the, you know, the text, says the preacher, invites us to do three things. First, to glorify and thank God, who is so solicitous that he sends ministers from the heavenly court to our aid. Second, to venerate the holy angels who so willingly and diligently care for us. And third, to exhibit greater reverence towards our neighbors, whom God and the holy angels honor so highly. The model sermon then lists seven ways in which the angels defend us against sin, and it contextualizes each of these seven ways with at least one scriptural passage, and at times also references the Glossa Ordinaria, it just calls it Glossa, or one of the Fathers. The sermon then lists seven other ways in which the spirits help us more generally, seven ways in which they defend us from exterior harm, like a wall falling on us or something, and seven ways in which they lead us from contemplation into action. Each of these sevenfold groupings is chocked full of authoritative quotations, mostly drawn from the Bible. The preacher then notes that this feast day is dedicated especially to Michael, prince of the universal church, and not to Raphael or to Gabriel, angels who have more particular commissions. The sermon then describes the general condition of all the angels, totus status angelorum, explaining that the angels are both active on earth, fulfilling their ministry, and contemplative in heaven, adoring God. Next, the preacher interweaves a few dicta attributed to Jerome and John Chrysostom between an abundant selection of scriptural passages, finally concluding his sermon by proclaiming, quote, "We should joyfully receive and venerate such angelic messengers, because through them our entire household will be made better, and we should not send them away empty, but with reverence draw near to them." This lengthy model sermon explicitly cites at least 57 different scriptural passages. And it seems that, in academic sermons, repeated and direct reference to the Bible was the norm. Thomas's Manipulus Florum, however, rarely cites scripture. For this florilegium to function effectively as an aid in composing sermons, biblical quotations would have to be added to its patristic and monastic dicta. It seems unlikely, then, that Thomas intended his compilation to function primarily as a preaching aid, especially since much fuller guides to sermon composition existed in the Sorbonne Library. Our anonymous model sermon for the Feast of St. Michael also rehearses at least 10 patristic dicta. And while the Manipulus Florum contains some of the same dicta under the headings Angelus and Diabolus, other passages found in the sermon, particularly the quotations of John Chrysostom, are not found in Thomas's Florilegium, the specific ones in the sermon. He does quote Chrysostom on other passages. Yet the readers of Thomas's text could use the appended bibliography to identify and locate Chrysostom's writings within the Sorbonne Library and could, if they so desired, search out the particular passages quoted in the model sermon. Or they could simply acquaint themselves more fully with Chrysostom's work. Finally, this model sermon discusses the Archangel Michael in some detail, yet Thomas's Florilegium provides very little information about this important spirit. In fact, the only mention of Michael is the one you saw under Angelus K. Just names him, doesn't tell you anything about him. Again, I question how helpful the Manipulus Florum would have been as a sermon composition aid, especially when comprehensive collections of model sermons were readily available in the Sorbonne Library, collections with which Thomas was almost certainly familiar. So, in conclusion, Thomas's Florilegium, despite its limitations, would have been a helpful academic resource in many ways. Its intended readers were certainly university students interested in the study of theology. Its lengthy bibliography makes this clear. It provides its users with a collection of authoritative dicta arranged conveniently under alphabetized keywords, yet it could not provide for all the needs of a university student. The Manipulus Florum does not provide a guide to the Bible, nor does it define complicated philosophical terminology, and students would have to seek such essential knowledge elsewhere. Even in theological matters, Thomas's Florilegium provides a scattered survey rather than a systematic overview. Certainly, academic readers of the Manipulus Florum could use this compilation as an aid in composing sermons, as a source of private spiritual reading, or as a primer in theology. They could also use it to identify key patristic and monastic texts within the Sorbonne Library, and thus become better acquainted with important works in Christianity's rich and complex tradition. The Manipulus Florum, despite its numerous limitations, is thus potentially useful to scholars and students in a variety of ways. And I think its versatility is the principal factor accounting for its remarkable success and popularity. Rather than try to identify one primary purpose in forming the creation of this text, we should acknowledge that Thomas intended his compilation to be useful in many ways. This is, after all, what Thomas says in his preface. Quote, "I have compiled here in alphabetical order certain better known and more common sayings, which often appear in sermons or lectures, and with which a person can improve himself in every way." Thank you.